Support for the Think Podcast comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering courses in art, literature, film, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. You can register online now for the upcoming fall programs at smu.edu/CAPE.
The most important piece of advice ever given to Stephen Colbert sounds like very bad advice indeed. Learn to love when you're failing. But Colbert abandoned his dramatic ambitions and found his voice in comedy only after he signed on with Chicago's legendary Second City improv troupe and began to deliberately court humiliation. The thing is, if you're going to get up on stage with a bunch of other people and make up an entire show as you go along, it helps if you're not afraid of embarrassment. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The format that launched Colbert's career is the same one that gave us Mike Nichols and Elaine May, John Belushi, Alan Arkin, Christopher Guest, and Tina Fey. It's improv, which writer Sam Wasson argues deserves a place right next to jazz as a uniquely American artistic innovation. Wasson is a writer with a background in improvisational performance. His new book is called Improv Nation: How We Made a Great American Art. Sam, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you.
There are lots of familiar names in this book, but I hadn't heard of Viola Spolin before. Mm-hmm. She was the almost accidental mother of improv.
Yeah, she's the one that got this going. And when she started thinking about improvisation, it wasn't improvisation for performance. She was a social worker, and she was in charge of overseeing the care of immigrant children in Chicago's Hull House just after the turn of the century. And she developed these games as a way to get these children to relate to each other. She wasn't thinking dramatically. She was just thinking in terms of breaking down barriers of self-consciousness.
So if you've come from Lithuania and the kid across the room has come from, Italy or something, you may not think you have anything in common until you play these games.
Yeah, you don't even have to have language in common to play these games, because Viola would say, just be in the where, which means just be in the space. You know, if I pull off of an invisible shelf an invisible cup and saucer, you don't have to speak English or whatever my native language is to know what it is that I'm doing. So you can relate to me immediately in that moment. And so these children who are separated by class, culture, language, race, everything, can absolutely come together in an improvised space. And it was Viola who conceived of and invented this.
And as Viola Spolin was leading these classes, she often brought along her stepson.
Or her son, Paul Sills.
Her son, excuse me, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Her son, Paul Sills, was one of the guinea pigs on which she helped to devise these games. So he grew up in this. This was his mother's business. But when Sills got to the University of Chicago in the 50s, he was the guy, along with a fellow named David Shepard, who decided to try these games on stage, to take what his mother has devised as a sort of backstage tool, a way to break down barriers, as I said. And Paul said, well, let's try to put these on stage and see what happens when we invite an audience.
This part of the story made me think of something that the writer and actor Stephen Tobolowsky likes to say, which is that you never know the beginning of a story. When something important happens, you don't necessarily see it in the moment.
Yeah, no one had any idea that what they were doing was A, going to be a theatrical presentational art form. That, like I said, that wasn't why Viola invented this stuff. And which is to say nothing of no one had any idea that this was going to birth Second City, which would then go on to be a source for Saturday Night Live and then Colbert. And no one had any idea this was going to happen, especially back in Chicago in the 1950s. Sills put his mother's games on stage as a way of helping non-professional actors, which is what he was interested in, speak to daily audiences.
So Paul Sills and Viola Spolin happened to live in Chicago. Was there something, though, also about the energy of the city that really made it a fertile ground for improv to take hold?
Yes, that's so important, that question. I mean, why Chicago? And the reason is because, just like you were talking about Colbert, you know, you need to have the freedom to fail, to improvise. And if you were to be improvising in, let's say, L.A. and New York, which are the centers of show business industry, you really wouldn't have the latitude to fail because it would be, whether consciously or unconsciously, an audition. Money would be on the line. Careers would be on the line. But for a bunch of non-professionals in Chicago, no one was thinking in terms of failure or success. So they really could be free. And Chicago, as the second city, second to New York, really allowed them the platform to crash and burn.
So how did Second City and its troupe begin to attract performers?
Well, very, very improvisationally, which is to say there was really no methodology for attracting improvisers because there really was no such thing as an improvisational performer or an improvisational comedian. People wouldn't grow up like they do now thinking, oh, I want to do this. I want to go to Second City. This is who I am. So Second City would get, you know, out-of-work actors coming by the theater and knocking on the door and saying, hey, wait a second, can I try this? Or Paul Sills would call up friends and say, you want to try this thing called improvisation? In the very beginning, there was really no call to this stuff except accidentally.
What did audiences make of this new kind of live performance?
They loved it pretty quickly, because it anyone can, even when an actor is bombing or an improviser is bombing, an audience can still be drawn into the drama of that bomb. In a great improvisation, you're always dealing with at least two levels. But the two levels that you're probably always dealing with are, one, the actor's struggle to make the improvisation work, and two, the character struggle, the character that the improviser is inventing at that particular moment. So even when you're bombing out, you're still emotionally drawn into the improviser's drama. And for that reason, along with several others having to do with freedom of speech, improvisation was pretty successful, pretty popular.
What really comes through in this book is the fact that you can be a truly great actor and not necessarily be great at improv. And you have a terrific story about, you know, Dustin Hoffman, everybody liked him, they knew he was a great actor, but he didn't really work in an improv situation.
Well, it's such an important distinction to say that this is a distinct art form. Mm-hmm. If actors could improvise and improvisers could act, then there wouldn't be a book here. This is a special skill set. And what makes it so egalitarian and therefore so American is that really anyone could do it. That's what Viola figured out. Which isn't to say that everyone can master it or everyone can be at the level of a Colbert or a Tina Fey, but certainly given the proper tools, given the rudimentary rules, you can get up there and you can play with other people. And that makes it, to me, not only equal to jazz in its improvisational potential, but even greater than jazz, because as we know, you have to know how to read music to play jazz. And I certainly don't. So I couldn't get up there and do it. But I could get up there and if not hold my own with Tina Fey, certainly tread water.
All right. Let's talk about some of those rules, because improv relies on performers making things up as they go. But it's not without some rules and some framing concepts. How did different traditions that organize different improv performances come into being?
Well, for every improvisational theater, there is a different improvisational philosophy. Mm-hmm. There are the hardcore Viola Spolin acolytes, who really do see this in terms of a sort of breaking down of emotional walls and freeing one spontaneous spirit. There's the Paul Sills acolytes who really see this as a community-building mystical power. There are Mike and Elaine's acolytes who are hardcore improvisational comedians. And also, these things emerge just naturally whenever somebody develops a new improvisational theater. Because improvisation contains multitudes and contains infinite voices, it can contain infinite theoretical approaches.
Well, it's interesting that you make the distinction, because not everybody, especially initially, associated improv with comedy. There were people who didn't think that comedy was necessarily the highest outcome for an improv performance.
Yeah, the comedy part happened accidentally. So it was Viola who started this. Paul Sills put it on stage, and then Sills cast in his theater, which was called the Compass Theater, which was the first improvisational theater in America, probably ever. He cast Mike Nichols and Elaine May. So it was only accidentally that this theater became funny.
Not everybody got the form right away. And you have a great story here about how even the great Mike Nichols had a learning curve before he could get to Yes And.
Yeah, well, Nichols was stuck in his head, like so many intellectuals. He was afraid to fail. He was afraid to let go. Because of it, would get very scared, and he would start in his own head obsessing while he was on the stage and failing himself. And right there, he just stops listening. He's not in the moment anymore the minute he's in his head. It really took Elaine, the genius of Elaine, to sort of reach a hand out to Mike and say, leap, Mike, because I'll catch you. And she did. And from that moment on, Nichols was much freer on stage and really came into his own as an improvisational comedian.
All right, I want to listen here to Nichols and May doing some of their most successful recurring characters, this couple of teenagers who are learning to deal with new special feelings that come about in adolescence.
This is the thing. I only get the car once a week.
Oh. Well, I think that, if a girl likes a boy, she'll ride on the bus.
I don't think I'm getting across to you. See, Ginny, the way I figure it, every human being has certain natural urges, and I got some.
I don't know what you mean. I mean, I don't know what you expected, you know? I don't know what George Green has told you about me in the last... But just the way figure is that you go out with somebody, you know, on your first date, and I mean you sort of have to talk to them or something. You have to get to know them or something, you know, and then later, like when you go out, you know, like on your second date, you know,
you ever ask me out again? I don't know if you will, but if you do,
then. Then that's a different thing then because, that's later. But this is our first date.
Ginny, do you know what you're going to say? I know exactly what you're going to say. You want to know? You're going to say I wouldn't respect you, right? Right? Look, Ginny, I want to tell you right here and now that I would respect you like crazy.
Mike Nichols and Elaine May, one of their teenagers' sketches. You note, Sam, that one of the reasons these characters worked so well is that they weren't trying to be overly jokey. They brought a certain amount of sincerity to the characters.
Yeah, I mean, this is what happened. This is a before and after moment in comedy for exactly that reason, because here you're presenting not just jokes, although there are a lot of jokes in there, but you're presenting two psychologies, two real people fumbling towards and away from each other. And that was a real watershed with improvisational comedy, and Nichols and May being the first two improvisational comedians, a watershed that they broke through into the world. So listening to that, it's hard to appreciate today how powerful that was, because this is the world that we live in, the world Mike and Elaine May made. But back in the 50s, there was absolutely no precedent for it.
My guest is author Sam Wasson. We're talking about his new book, Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Doctor of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening doctoral program where you can distinguish yourself personally and professionally. More at smu.edu/DLS.
I had studied acting in college and playwriting, and it was not until I started studying improvisation in Chicago that I really felt like I found, oh, this is what makes sense to me. This is the kind of work I want to do. I'm an improviser first. And the idea that when you're improvising, you are serving your partner as opposed to being out there by yourself and showing off.
You smell like your father.
The only reason I smell like my father is because you won't let me wear perfume and I have to wear Old Spice.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boy. That was Tina Fey talking about her time at Second City, followed by a short skit along with Rachel Dratch. If you would like to join our conversation with author Sam Wasson, whose new book is called Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372. It's really interesting, Sam, because people like Tina Fey, people like Stephen Colbert, Alan Arkin, who we've had on the show in the past, will talk about the importance of doing this for a long time to get good at it. Can you talk a little bit about what changes as you practice improv, what you start to be able to see and focus on that aren't apparent the first time you try it?
Wow. Well, everything that's good, basically. You get out of your head where everything is that could be bad is bad, and you get into the present moment. And 99.99% of the time, the present moment is okay and it's safe. So a lot of improvisers who do this work theatrically find that over time, if they apply it to their lives, and they learn to yes and they learn to, as Tina Fey said, focus on making the other person look good, their worries go away and they find new adventures in life. They yes and the circumstances of their everyday and end up in some miraculous place they never would have if they weren't yes anding. So this is life-changing work, and it's part of why anyone who does it in any sustained way finds it almost to be like a religion.
And yet, for all those therapeutic benefits, there are people like the legendary improv master Del Close. He was unquestionably brilliant and kind of a disaster personally.
Yeah, well, the incredible thing, one of the incredible things about Del Close was that when he was improvising at his peak, when his artistic cylinders were all firing, he was not in his addiction. It was only when he was told no by the creative powers that be that he would fall back. So improvisation really gave him a way to get out of himself, to get out of his concerns. It was, to a certain extent, healing for Del Close. Of course, it took serious recovery to get him to beat those demons. But until he did, he had the joy and freedom of artistic creation.
How did improv evolve as it began to spread to other cities like New York and L.A. and Toronto?
Well, let's see. It got to New York. It was a fellow by the name of Ted Flicker, who was affiliated with the Compass in St. Louis, who brought improvisation, was the first person to bring improvisation to New York in the form of the Premise Players. That was in the early 60s. And his angle was far less metaphysical than Paul Sills. He was interested, naturally, in creating a more polished entertainment, something that was more New York ready. Out of the Premise Players came, amongst other improvisers, Buck Henry. But it was an improvisation appropriate to New York. Improvisation has to suit the place it's in. It has to suit its audience, because if it doesn't, the improvisers aren't listening to the audience, and the audience is the sort of invisible player in this as well. So to summarize, improvisation has to suit its native theater, its native place.
You note that Stephen Colbert, on his scripted nightly TV show, The Colbert Report, which is a little bit different than what he does now on CBS, but he would tell audiences, there are two characters in this scene. I am one playing, you know, this sort of pompous version of himself, and you, the audience, are the other character.
That's right. I mean, it is a conversation, even if it's not a literal conversation, even if the audience isn't literally speaking back to the players, which, of course, they are in the beginning when they give a suggestion. They literally are telling the players what they want. In their silence and in their laughter, a good improviser can pick up cues from the audience and respond to them improvisationally. And Colbert, trained in Second City, completely understood that.
How long did it take for improv to be equally open to women and to people of color as it had been to white men?
Well, it was open to women pretty quickly. I mean, like I said, there was Elaine was the foremost genius of improvisational comedy immediately. And there was Barbara Harris in the first company and several other women. The first time, I would say the first significant attempt to integrate improvisation happened after The Premise. Ted Flicker opened what he called The Living Premise, which was a company of two white people and two black people, and they were meant to really solve the racial problem improvisationally in front of live audiences. And I go into a lot of their experiments in the book, some of which were not funny and shocking, and some of which were touching and wonderful, and some of which were absolutely hilarious. But that moment, which very few people know about, I think it was 1963, was really the most profound moment of integration. And as far as I know, the most exciting moment in exploring America's race problem improvisationally to date.
I want to play a little bit here of the actor John Belushi. This is him doing his Joe Cocker character, which is actually a really good impersonation of Joe Cocker. We'll talk about it after we hear it.
What would you do if I sang half to? Would you stand up and look down? Would you lay on me your ear and I'll sing you a song? I will try not to sing out a kid. Oh, baby, I'll get high. Oh, don't you know I want to get high? Oh, don't you know I want to get my brain?
That was John Belushi as version of Joe Cocker. My guest this hour is author Sam Wasson. His book is called Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. What made Belushi so brilliant at improv?
Oh, God. Well, at first he wasn't so brilliant. It took Joe Flaherty, who was sort of like the father of his particular improvisational generation, to say to Belushi, listen, this can't just be the Belushi show. You've got to listen to what the other player is giving you. Hmm. And when Belushi got that, he did learn how to improvise. But what made Belushi great? I mean, that's a bottomless question. What I love about Belushi is that he brought rock and roll to improvisation, not just literally, but the spirit of rock and roll. He brought real rage and intensity, and that hadn't really been seen. I'm thinking now as I'm saying this, that really hadn't been seen on the improvisational stage before.
Where do you put a figure like Bill Murray in the pantheon of improv? It seems like he was sort of hot and cold on the things required to be successful at this collaborative art form.
That's it. He's very mixed for me. You know, when Murray is great, no one is better. But in order for Murray to be great, his co-players have to subscribe to the Murray Code, which is a nebulous and ever-changing set of criteria that has to do with class and power. And if Murray is playing with someone who offends him, I mean, who offends his political principles, which is to say someone that he sees as high status, Murray will have a hard time playing with them. And then Murray doesn't become the greatest guy. But if you're on Murray's wavelength, you know, you're going to paradise.
It's interesting to think that he came to improv really on the coattails of his now less famous but working actor brother, Brian Doyle Murphy.
Right. And it's I mean, we talked earlier in the hour about how improvisers got to Second City. These guys lived in Chicago. They didn't grow up wanting to be improvisers. There was no one did. It didn't exist. So a lot of what you see of early Second City consists of people who just happened to be in Chicago. Harold Ramis is another one of those guys. Belushi is another one of those guys. And the Murray brothers, absolutely.
What's the relationship between fully improvisational comedy, the sort of thing that is taking shape before our eyes when we are live in a live audience, and the sort of sketch comedy performed on shows like Saturday Night Live and Inside Amy Schumer and Key and Peele?
Well, this is one of the debates that runs throughout my book, which is, what is improvisation? On one hand, you have something pure and extreme, which is, can I get a suggestion? Go. And you literally invent it right there on the spot. And on the other extreme, you have improvisers like Mike and Elaine who improvisate earlier improvisations, like that teenager sketch that we heard. That wasn't improvised for the first time when we heard it. That was improvised for the first time on stage, but then they would re-improvise and then re-improvise, and they would sort of go back to it over and over again. So between those two poles is a whole range of ways to think of and approach improvisation. Second City has one way of doing it. The Improv Olympic or IO has another way of doing it. It all depends on your theater and your personal ambition.
There's a really strong improv tradition that comes out of Toronto, Canada.
Well, that started when Bernie Sollins, who was one of the producers of Second City in Chicago, said to Joe Flaherty, who I mentioned earlier, do you want to go up and start something in Canada? There was really no ambition nobler than that. It was that Sollins knew a guy with a theater. He was a businessman and thought, what the heck? And it just so happened that Bernie backed into a gold mine of genius, and by that I'm thinking Martin Short, Andrea Martin, Eugene Levy, Catherine O'Hara, Dan Aykroyd, on and on. So he sort of fumbled into the backyard of greatness there.
I'm really curious about the idea that Second City television sort of came as a response to Saturday Night Live, and there was an interesting kind of back and forth in this sense that everybody had to sort of keep up with what was being done and innovated elsewhere.
Right. So when Saturday Night Live happens in 75, Second City players, both in Toronto and Chicago, are starting to be poached. Lorne Michaels is coming to Second City and he's saying, oh, I want that one. I want that one. He's sort of shopping. Well, that creates a problem at Second City, because Second City then realizes, wait a second, we're losing our talent to New York. The way to keep the talent at home, Andrew Alexander was one of the producers of Second City. They decided that they had to form their own answer to Saturday Night Live at home, and that became SCTV.
Lorne Michaels today has a reputation for being very strict about not having anybody break character or really improvise on the air on SNL.
Yeah, it's not an improvised show, Saturday Night Live. It's really important to remember that these are sketches, basically. Literally, these are sketches. However, the live element to Saturday Night Live, that feeling that anything can happen, and indeed almost anything can happen on Saturday Night Live, is essential to the show's success and the sort of rebel feeling that was part of its conception. And of course, an improviser, a trained improviser, would be predisposed to handle that live aspect of the show better than, say, probably a film actor.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. If you'd like to join our conversation with author Sam Wasson about his book Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372. Okay, I want to talk about people like Christopher Guest, who took improvisation and applied it to something that most people imagine could only be done with a really strictly and carefully written script. Talk a little bit about how Guest has played with the format.
Well, Guest, of course, was part of Spinal Tap. Before that, he had his own history with the Lampoon Show, where he met a lot of these improvisers. But on Waiting for Guffman, which is really the first breakthrough Christopher Guest movie, he and Eugene Levy, who was also an improviser, they sat down and they beat out a sort of outline for this story. And from that outline, the improvisers would just improvise on camera. They knew their characters. They knew the situations that they would be in. But the moment the camera rolled, everyone for the first time was discovering what was being said. So again, where do you put that on the spectrum of improvisation from no one knowing anything to Mike and Elaine? Well, it goes somewhere in the middle. And that's really the sweet spot for Christopher Guest.
I was surprised to read that he almost left out most of the scenes that feature himself as Corky St. Clair in that movie.
Yeah, well, look, like every other comedian, he's full of self-doubt, even self-loathing, and so when he sees himself on camera, the liability is that he's going to be too hard on himself. It took Eugene Levy to say to him, okay, Chris, you've gone too far. Not only have you gone too far, but this is one of the most brilliant comic creations I've ever seen, and you got to put all that stuff back in the movie. So we owe Eugene Levy a big thank you for saving Christopher Guest, Corky St. Clair.
Does a vein of self-doubt, self-loathing, it seems to run through so many of the greatest luminaries in American comedy. Is that somehow essential, a kind of lack of self-confidence that is disguised by going out there and pretending that nothing scares you?
Yeah, it is. I would say it is essential. I mean, comedy is about rage. It is about saying, there is a problem here. This doesn't make sense. And when that rage is turned against the self, as it so often can be, it becomes self-loathing and it becomes depression. And that's why a lot of comedians, I would say most every comedian, has that tendency.
We have a tweet here from Stephen who wants to know, for the novice, are there prerequisites or a resume required to get involved with an improv company?
Absolutely not. Thank you for asking that. Because anyone can improvise, anyone can get involved with an improv company. Now, different improv companies have different criteria for involvement, so you may not be the most qualified person, but if you play the games and you do the work and you figure out how to do this, you could make it.
My guest is author Sam Wasson. We're talking about his book, Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. We'll take your calls after the break. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Support for the Think Podcast comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, a customizable evening master's program for working professionals. You can apply now for the fall of 2017. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Every rule of improv is the exact opposite of show business. So every rule of improv, got your back, I'm there for my partner, I'm succeeding,
serve the other person. Exactly, I follow the follower, serve the servant. Yes, and you're more important than
I am. Yeah. The opposite of show business.
So, exactly. Get out of my way, daddy's talking.
I need to be a star.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was Keegan-Michael Key and Stephen Colbert talking about improv on Late Night. My guest this hour is author Sam Wasson, whose book is called Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. How do you maintain that ethos of the other person is more important than you, paying attention and not necessarily needing to be the star? If, because you're a performer, obviously there's something about getting up on stage that that appeals to you as an improv performer.
Right. So if you start improvising with that need for an ego rush that many performers have, you find that over time it goes away. You really cannot sustain that as an improviser. If you're thinking just about yourself, you're not open to what the other person is giving you. So improv kills all of that immediately. It has to.
All right, let's go to the phones. First up, we have Paul calling from Austin. Hi, Paul.
Hi, yes. I'm a vocal improviser here in Austin, and I was just curious how you felt about the spread of improv theaters, specifically improv theaters over the past 30 years or so, from places like here at the Hideout Theater here in Austin, shout out, to further more disparate places like Juno or maybe improv in London.
Thanks for your call, Paul.
I'm excited about it. I mean, I want there to be an improv theater in every neighborhood. I want neighborhoods to flock to their improvisational theaters to see their community's problems performed back to them, not just for laughs, but for truth. So the upward trajectory of improvisation and improv comedy is thrilling to me.
You know, you think about playing as a child, and you're able to get all the kids in the neighborhood or all the kids in your family together, and everybody sort of does that yes and. They agree, okay, we're on a rocket ship, we're going to do this thing, and everybody goes into it. And then somehow, I don't know if we become more self-conscious and we lose that ability to play. And improv seems like one of the only ways that adults are given to do that again.
Yes, improv is play. The reason we don't use the word play, or I shy away from the word play, is that it sounds like something a child does, and then sometimes adults become embarrassed to say they're playing. But yes, in our hearts, what we're doing is playing. And what's so wonderful about play is that it's really the only thing that you can do that won't hurt you. That's only purely good. You know, even love hurts, as we know, famously, you know? But play doesn't hurt. You can do it and do it and do it, and you won't get hurt, and you won't OD on it.
We have an email here from Joel in Dallas who wants to know how Jonathan Winters fits into this discussion. He was clearly improvisational and brilliant very early on.
Right. No, that's an important distinction. I mean, Jonathan Winters, you think of more as a solo artist. And when you're improvising as a soloist, you're not really improvising because you can fall back on your own personal riffs. Like what I'm doing right now, being in an interview, even though I'm making it up, I've been asked a lot of these questions before. So I have, in a way, almost ready-made answers. And that tends to be the case when you're dealing with solo improvisation. In order to get truly into the improvisational unknown, you need someone else to push you someplace that you've never been before. You have to be out of control.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Mariana calling from Austin. Hi, Mariana.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes. Hi, Sam. I just got introduced to the whole comedy improv. I'm new to it. I just started classes. I completed my second class, and I'm wondering, really interested in learning if there's anything in your book for me as a novice.
Well, yeah, I mean, the story of improvisation will give you a great sampling of all the different tools that have been used up to this point. I mean, that's one of the reasons really to study history is to see what other people have done. So you'll see all the powers that are available to you, and then you'll be able to sort of mix and match them to suit your own personal needs and invent your own way of doing it.
Is improv still evolving? Like, are games still being invented that spread to different theaters around the country?
Yeah, I just heard about a game before I stepped into this interview. Yes, improvisation is always being reinvented wherever you go because the rules are only inclusive. So improvisation can withstand reinvention at all times.
All right, back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Sean calling from Grapevine. Hi, Sean.
Hi, Chris. I'm up at Dallas Comedy House. I do improv up there. I'm also the president of my college's improv club. And I was wondering, I noticed there's very little competitive edge, there's very little competitive nature to improv as opposed to like stand-up, for example. And I was wondering why our guest thinks that is.
Well, it's about supporting the other player in improvisation. You have to work together to find out where you're going. That requires cooperation. In stand-up, which is for the most part has been written in advance, the performer can have an idea of what failure or success is. Oh, I wanted them to laugh. I needed to do that joke better. I should have done. There are so many shoulds in stand-up that it creates a sense of failure and really enhances the comedian's sense of self-loathing. But improv, like I said, requires total collaboration.
Mike Nichols, of course, one half of Nichols and May, would come to be known as a brilliant film director. He made movies like Silkwood and The Birdcage and, of course, The Graduate. I'm curious as to how you think his background in improv may have shaped Nichols as a director.
I think Nichols ended up not becoming the improvisational director that he himself thought he might have been. At a certain point, I mean, when he made Catch-22, which came out, I believe, the same year as Robert Altman's MASH, he saw MASH and he saw Altman's improvisational style. And he thought, well, Altman is, I think, maybe the director that I should have been. But Mike was more of a perfectionist. He was more about polishing the diamond. Okay, well, I discovered something in improvisation, he would say. Let me put it into the movie and let me go back and make it as perfect as I possibly can. Whereas Elaine May, his former comedy partner, when she went into making films, she would just improvise and improvise and improvise and improvise. There was very little going back with Elaine.
So for Mike Nichols, improv ultimately was a means to an end.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And for Elaine, it was an end.
All right. I want to go back to the phones. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Gary on the line in Beaumont. Hey, Gary.
Hi. I want to know what you all think of the Whose Line Is It Anyway show on CW, which I think is the best that I know of right now.
Thanks for your call.
Well, I haven't seen the current iteration of it, but when I hear Whose Line Is It Anyway, I think of Ryan Stiles, who is the Second City performer, and Josie Lawrence, and it's just breathtaking what those guys can do. That is a kind of don't try this at home improvisation. I mean, when Viola says everyone can improvise, she doesn't mean everyone can improvise comedy. That is a separate thing, and that's reserved for a level of genius and quick-wittedness that God knows where that comes. So when you're seeing Whose Line Is It Anyway, at its best, that's a lot of what you're seeing. Again, it's its own interpretation of what it means to improvise.
It would seem that in some ways there's a great advantage to having worked with the people around you for a long time, knowing them very well. At the same time, I almost wonder if it's like, you know, a longstanding relationship where you feel like there are no surprises left. Is there some value to also mixing it up with people you don't know?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you can do no wrong here. If you believe, as I do, that the unconscious is bottomless, and the more you improvise with any single person, the deeper you can go, then, in fact, maybe it's the opposite of what you're saying. And the better you know someone, the more you can explore. There's really no wrong way to do this as long as you are saying yes and.
All right, let's go back to the phone. Hunter is calling us from Dallas. Hi, Hunter.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Big fan of the show.
Thanks.
I'm interested in what role improv plays in the CIA as far as undercover type situations. And if you know instances where an act of improv has shaped our American history.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Well, I mean, listen, aren't we improvising the amendments to the Constitution all the time? I mean, this is such an analog to our government. And one of the epigraphs, or the epigraph I use in the book, I took from Harold Clurman's book about the group theater. He says, America is the only modern nation in a current state, in a continuous state of revolution. I could be messing that up slightly. But yes, we are a work in progress. So I think to that extent, improvisation is very American. As to your question about the CIA, I would love to know the answer. I think it's very exciting. I don't know the answer, but I'm sure the CIA is on it as we speak.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We talked about the fact that there's not a whole lot of competition when you are up on stage with a group of people doing improv, or at least there shouldn't be if it's to work right. What about competition between different improv troupes?
Well, there was in the 90s, the era that Tina Fey and Colbert came of artistic age, there were, by that point, different improv theaters in Chicago with their own different philosophies. There was Second City, there was I.O., there was the coming Upright Citizens Brigade and the Annoyance Theater, and they each felt so passionately about their own particular approach to improvisation that there was clash between them. But it ended up being a very healthy clash because finally, as improvisers, these different theaters started to yes and each other's style to the degree that they finally took what was best about their so-called enemies and deepened their own work. So by the end of it, the opposition actually helped all of them.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I want to speak quickly here to Chris in Austin. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I wonder if improv players do anything about trying to communicate with Alzheimer's patients through improv, either themselves or by demonstrating to people. This was how I was able to communicate with my mother for quite some time. When Mom saw an ocean liner going down the street, I would pick that up and play off it. Hmm. And Mom enjoyed it, I enjoyed it, and it took me for a while out of that awkwardness of stumbling around trying to find a way to connect.
What a beautiful story.
That is that is exactly the new frontier in improvisation that's going on right now at Second City and other places. They are talking about improvising with Alzheimer's patients. And to just sort of reframe that story, basically that's a yes and. Someone with the illness will make a remark that is sort of like a suggestion, and the other player or person yes ands it. So this is so exciting, and this really is the next frontier for improvisation, and there is so much work going on with it right now.
It seems like it might also work for conflict resolution in certain cases.
Well, now we're getting to it. The applications to this stuff are infinite. They are metaphysical, as Paul Sills believed. They are emotional, as Mike and Elaine believe. There are neurologists studying improvisation that say there are strong medical benefits to connecting with another person. Obviously, this book is about the artistic. They are political. This is democracy in action. So improvisation is virtually good for virtually everything.
What have you learned, Sam, about what sets the best improv performers apart from those who are merely capable?
Well, it depends what type of improv we're talking about. I think the common thread here is A, an ability to listen, an ability to be fearless, and C, an ability to be patient. I found that improvisers who are in a rush often will not be susceptible to the more uncomfortable, the more surprising emotional curveballs that come their way. And on the other side of those are the most exciting scenes and experiences that a person could have both in an improvisational theater and in life.
It sounds a lot like doing the research for a nonfiction book as well.
You got it.
The new book by author Sam Wasson is called Improv Nation: How We Made a Great American Art. Sam, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERATHINK. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think. You can subscribe to the podcast and find archives of years worth of shows at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.